Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW, 1150 AM Seattle, Alternative Talk Radio, and you are in the House of Mystery alone today, because my cohort is on assignment, Kev Thompson, so it's just me, Al Warren, but we'll still have a good time. So, continuing along, of course, we're doing more true crime this month. And joining us is, he's new to the show, and he's got an interesting series of novellas coming out, and the first one is out now, and it's called The Mulatto Ripper, and it's the Miss Clytie Cases, Book 1, and I'll get all corrected on that as we talk. So, welcome to the show, James Jeffrey Paul.
Thank you, Alan, and I appreciate your inviting me on your show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always good to have new talent come in and talk about what they're doing. And Lee Mahler introduced us, and of course I've known him, and he's usually a pretty good pick of talent, especially in crime and murder.
I'd like to just say a word of compliment towards him, if I may. I've worked with many editors and proofreaders in my sporadic writing career. It's only recently that I've been able to pursue it full time. I must say, though, Lee is absolutely the finest editor I've ever worked with, bar none. If there's something missing in the story that you completely did not think of, he'll notice it. If you're confused about how to proceed, he will, as he did once when we were editing one of the later books in the series, says, well, why don't you why don't we just discard this scene and you write a new one? And I did. And he says, no, it still doesn't work. How about we discard half this new scene and take back half of the old scene and blend them together? And by gosh, it flowed smoother than, I don't know, Jim Beam from a decanter or something.
But that's great. That's great. You know, a lot of times people that are not writers or not in the business don't realize how important the connection can be between co-writers or publishers and editors, and how it can actually make a difference when it's a real good team and people play off of each other. It's very important.
And yes, and the sad thing is a lot of people are too egotistical to even want advice, which is absolutely suicidal, because now editors aren't flawless. I mean, editors can, I mean, sometimes I made suggestions. I think a couple, once or twice, Lee's made a suggestion that I thought about it and said, no, I really don't like that. And he's, you know, big enough to say, well, that's okay. But we have a relationship built on mutual respect and mutual cooperation. And that's absolutely fantastic for a writer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, because no matter who I'm working with when I'm writing and doing things, it's a two-way street or three-way street. You pick up off of each other and you learn from each other in the experience. It's the creation that's important. So, yeah, leave the ego at the door.
Yes.
So James, let's start about you. What first of all, got you into writing and writing this type of series of books?
Well, I have been interested in writing and loved reading since I was a child. And really, Ayn Rand was a very popular best-selling novelist, and some people take every statement she made as if it were gospel. However, she once made the most idiotic statement I've ever heard in my life. Writers are made, not born, which is, I can tell you from personal experience, it's utter nonsense. The urge to write, the interest in the mechanics of writing, it shows itself at a very early age, and it has nothing to do with your willing it. It's just part of how you're wired, I think. The question is, will you nurture the gift and keep at it and try to make something of it?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Sure. Now, so the Mulatto Ripper, what is this series about? Kind of what's the idea behind it?
Well, I've always been fascinated by crimes that are virtually unknown, that you just come across vague references to in newspaper articles or in, just a sentence or two in some ancient encyclopedia of crime. And I can tell you exactly when I first heard of this case. I was very fascinated once by the still unsolved case of the Axeman of New Orleans. And who is Huey Long, by the way? It made a mention that in one of the New Orleans, I think it was in the New Orleans Times Picayune, I was looking up an article, and it said, several years ago in Atlanta, a man killed a number of Negro women by slashing their throats and then stole their shoes. And I just thought, huh? And then several years later, full confession, Michael Newton, the crime historian, whom I'm sure you know,
oh, yeah,
is a friend of mine on Facebook. And because I learned of the second book in my series from an entry in one of his numerous crime encyclopedias, I'm dedicating book number two to him. But when I was looking through one of his crime encyclopedias, I learned about the Atlanta Ripper, and I learned that now no one knows. Now, as with most unsolved serial killers, no one really seems to know exactly how many victims he claimed. But between 1911 and 1912, somewhere between probably 15 or 16 and 20, the figures vary, women were killed. They were had their throats cut, and sometimes had their genitals mutilated as well by an unknown assailant. And he was called the Atlanta Ripper. And at first, there was news about him in the local Atlanta press. But to show you that sometimes economics trumps humanity, he really started getting lots of publicity when black serving women who worked in the wealthier houses owned by whites on the, quote, nicer side of town were so afraid to go home lest they encounter the Ripper that they either were asked to just stay or they'd beg their male employers to take them home. And suddenly it became a tremendous financial pain in the neck for the more affluent portion of Atlanta that kept black servants. And so suddenly the Ripper was all over the place and his body count began to rise. And as far as I know, now please forgive me, I don't have my novel right with me, nor do I have the only book ever written on the case, but which I highly recommend. It's by a Georgian named Jeffrey Wells, called The Atlanta Ripper, a nice, very well-researched short book. And the Ripper was only seen twice. Once, as a black serving girl was leaving out the back door into the back alley of her employer's residence, suddenly she saw she described him as a tall, heavy-set black man creeping towards her, and if memory serves, he'd taken off his shoes, and I think he was holding in his hands or something, so she wouldn't hear him. And she screamed and ran, you know, banged on the door, ran back inside. And what was most incredible, which really showed you that this Ripper, didn't want to get caught, he was also just displayed this breathtaking arrogance. And when her employer went outside, the Ripper was still there, standing in the same spot, just sort of staring at him insouciantly. And then the Ripper took off and ran. But so you can see that this was a very careful, very crafty and cunning killer. But at the same time, I mean, think about it. You're committing a murder. You're planning on committing a murder. Your victim sees you, screams for employer. Her employer runs inside. He comes out. And then the killer's just still standing there like he doesn't have a care in the world or something. And I thought, what incredible arrogance. And then what was even worse, Ripper's worst night of slaughter happened in the summer of 1911. One night, a woman named Lena Sharp, who was 40 years old if memory serves, went out, told her daughter, "I'm going to the grocery store to get some groceries." But her mom never returned, and her daughter began to grow nervous. And then she went out looking for her mom, and suddenly she encountered, again, the same description, a tall, heavy-set, well-dressed black man, and something, and there he was standing in her path, and something about his manner made her very nervous. And again, he had the unparalleled arrogance to say, "Why are you looking at me like that? I never bother girls like you." But then, as she just hurried past him, he pulled out his knife and, laughing, stabbed her several times in the back, then ran away. And luckily, she survived, but as it turned out, her mother was already dead. She'd encountered the Ripper shortly after he killed her mom. And the case, though as in many cases, especially cases that involved black suspects, needless to say, many, many innocent black suspects were hauled in and given the third degree. Some were even charged individually with some of the murders. If memory serves, they all either got off, or one might have been convicted, but then was released on a technicality. But after a year or so, it was evident that the Ripper was gone, and he's never been seen since. And so I realized that I'd found this fascinating case in just those images, this tall black man creeping up on someone in an alley with his shoes off, and then just standing there when he's discovered, or after he's just killed a woman, he encounters another woman who he doesn't realize is his victim's daughter, and then says, "Why are you looking at me like that? I never bother women like you." I mean, why didn't he just say, "Of course I'm the Ripper, but I never choose girls like you for my victims." It was just, now, this fellow was crafty. He didn't want to get caught, but his arrogance just, I keep thinking about it. Every time I think about it, it's like a punch to the solar plexus. It just takes my breath.
Yeah. How much do you think is arrogance and how much is the time? You know, we're looking at 1911. Atlanta had maybe 150,000 people, but segregation was big. Did this really cause a concern amongst white women in white areas? Because they were still trying to keep black communities separate from them. They didn't want black owners owning in their community.
And it was just several years since the Atlanta riots of 1906.
Right. So,
go ahead.
So I was just wondering how much, maybe he felt empowered by that, in a sense, because his victims were all, what were they, in their 20s, and they were black females.
Well, actually, the reason the book is called The Mulatto Ripper, it's what my fictional detective, it's the nickname my fictional detective gives him, because most, though not all, of the Ripper's of definite victims were of mixed race. In fact, one white newspaper noted that, that the women were of mixed race, but he killed no out-and-out colored women, as if that somehow mattered. But apparently the killer himself was very dark skinned, and he, and just my armchair psychoanalysis, the fact that he worked at night sometimes and never during the day, and that he could at least afford a nice fancy suit, made me think he must have been at least, he must have had a job in the black community, and he must have been at least prosperous enough that he could afford to splurge a little on what he wore. So I don't think it was a case of, I don't know really. All I know is that serial killers, now this may just be, this may just be one of the old saws that are tossed about, and that you hear some FBI analysts say on TV, and then of course it becomes accepted wisdom, and then of course you hear in a few weeks another FBI analyst come on TV. I've heard a lot about that, but that's utter nonsense. Serial killers really do be. And then FBI agent number three comes on. Absurd. Serial killers always follow the C pattern. No, no, no. And then says agent number four. It's a mixture of A and C or B and A, but never A and C. I just don't think much of, I don't want to sound like Donald Trump, but I'm beginning to doubt a lot of expert opinion that I hear on TV a lot.
Well, I think you have to take it with generalizations. You know, they have general ideas, you know, about serial killers, you know, and they come up with thoughts and action patterns, and quite often they can be right, but it's not necessarily the way it is, and certainly not with every serial killer. So you just kind of have to take that as information that could help.
Yes. You know. What I will say is I do believe that most serial killers pick the gender and race and age group usually. Now some are much more indiscriminate, but I think in general serial killers pick on a victim group that they're sexually attracted to. If they never felt an urge to kill, they would be asking women like that out on dates, not trying to murder them. So I just think this fellow probably was attracted to light-skinned black women. If there was any racism involved at all, it might have been based on the fact that he apparently, as people described him, was a dark-skinned black person, and that perhaps secretly he considered black people of mixed race inferior, even though he found them attractive. So maybe picking on them allowed him to pick on someone he felt easily superior to.
Right.
That's my only possible insight.
Yeah. And so now this story, not real popular in the nowadays, like people, this is the first kind of I've heard of this story and found out about it. Now it lasted just over a year. What made you actually decide to write a series of books dealing with this? Or are you going to different other crimes with your main character?
Oh, no. The crime is solved at the end of this book. But my books hop around in time from say 1911. My female private detective is just starting to work for the detective agency she works for. She is 21 years old, and this is one of her first big cases, so it's a very exciting moment to her, especially when, you know, in my novel, she's there that night prowling about when the Ripper creeps up on tiptoes to the serving girl as she's leaving the house, and she calls for help, and then, you know, it's she who helps give chase to him, so she never forgets the fact that, you know, she once saw him face to face. Now, a few of my novels skip about in time very widely, which is another... My series is a very unorthodox series, and like I said, in that it has such a wide range of time and many different settings across the country.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
And many different types of crimes and many different situations. But in this book, it begins in 1961, 50 years after the crimes began. Miss Clydie's now an old lady in her early 70s, and she returns to Atlanta to work on some business and handle a little case. And of course she can't help remembering all that's happened and can't believe it was 50 years ago. But then she gets a call from a very old man who says he's the Ripper, and he tells her things that only the Ripper could possibly have known, and things about, and talks about meeting her that night, and he wants to meet her for lunch the following day, and then he wants to take her on a walk around his old stomping grounds. And so, in a way, it takes her a half a century to solve the case, but the Ripper has to turn himself in to her. Now, it's not quite as, it doesn't unfold as simply as all that. There are some very interesting twists all throughout the book that I won't spoil it for you, but a lot of the book is either the two of them talking about the past and why it happened, and whenever they reach a spot that has meaning to both of them, a murder scene, or the Ripper shows where he worked, or a church where a lot of sermons about the murders were preached, they'll stop, and then sometimes it'll just fade all the way into flashback 50 years ago. And, you know, and I thought that that was really a very original way of doing it. And you'd think, well, if the killer turns himself in or reveals his identity 50 years later, I mean, well, what's the point? Well, the point is, and like I said, one, there's some very unexpected twists and turns in the present-day plot, and two, it's sort of a neat way that the two of them revisit the old spots where all of this stuff happened and remember things that only they could remember, and we get to see a lot of flashbacks to the main story from 1911.
Yeah. What can you tell us about your primary character and how she came about and kind of some aspects toward her?
Well, I'm thankful that so few people, thus far at least, have said, well, how can you be so politically incorrect and assume that you, white male, know how to, what a black woman would think? But really, that's just how she came to me. I didn't consciously will it that way. I do like to write about characters who are very different from myself and who've had very different experiences than myself, because I like to stretch my imagination. But somehow she just came to me that way. I don't recall the exact moment, but I thought, now there have been some, and I looked it up, there are some contemporary noir stories and novels about black female detectives, especially, it seems, about black female cops. And, you know, occasionally you hear about a black female detective, but really, private detectives or detectives working for agencies, at least in Europe and North America, I don't know, they seem to be exclusively, when you're talking about female, they're exclusively the province of white or sometimes Asian women. There is that series set in Africa about the ladies' book club. What is it called? Those set of books set in Africa? Do you recall?
No, I'm not on it.
But the fact that this was such an original premise, and that as I'm planning it, I have contracts for the first 7 books, novellas, in my series, and I just finished the first draft of number 6, but I'm planning 10 in all. And the story begins, the first story, this one, begins in 1911. The last one begins in 1985, when she's 95, and still spry and in very good mental and physical health, but mostly retired now, except for people constantly coming to her and nagging her and asking her for advice. You think about it. You take a black woman in a profession that black women are seldom portrayed in, and you have it span almost the entire 20th century. You follow her across many decades of her life all over the country, taking on all sorts of crimes and all sorts of locales. For instance, number two in my book, The Inquisition for Blood, which I dedicated to Michael Newton, as I said, because I learned of the case involved through one of his entry on his crime encyclopedias, is based on a series of voodoo-inspired axe murders of entire families, most of whom were of mixed race or had mixed race members, the color conflict again. And the reason the title comes from the fact that on the door of one of the houses where the entire family had been butchered, someone wrote a quote from Psalm 8 or Psalm 9, "When he maketh inquisition for blood, he forgetteth them not. He remembereth the cry of the humble." So that's where the title, The Inquisition for Blood, comes in. Now, some people were arrested and a few even charged with some of those crimes, but basically they're listed as unsolved. Well, in fact, the entire sect was wiped out. It was Miss Clydie's early triumphs. I mean, thanks to her, she pretty much wipes the entire group out. I mean, she doesn't just shoot them dead in their tracks. She uses phony magic and reverse psychology and just pretty much decimates them. I must admit, that was a tremendously fun book to write because I wanted to show how intelligent and how much of a creative thinker she was and how good a psychologist she was and how she could use that to just, you know, without firing a shot or raising a knife, just demolish your enemies.
Wow. How much time does it take for you to work with your character, create your character, and where do you draw from?
As I've been working on my stories, I've realized Lee Miller kept asking me, well, what is the basic arc in the series? And at first I thought, arc in the series? Well, it's just a life-to-death structure. But then suddenly it occurred to me, and again, I applaud Lee for asking me a question to which I already knew the answer, but I didn't realize I knew the answer. Does that make any sense? He made me really think about something that I hadn't really thought about, but it's very important. In the first two books, she's young and clever and really shows what a great detective she is. In number three, arranging a lynching, which is set in rural Rocky Mount, North Carolina in the early 1920s. Miss Flighty and her agency are trying to stop an epidemic of lynchings that's broken out in the area. So it started out as whites lynching blacks, but now, as sometimes happened in the South, it's now some blacks are lynching whites. And without going into too much detail, again, I don't want to do any spoilers, Miss Clydie is a very modern detective in that, you know, modern detectives for about the past century, some people describe them as sort of, they're almost semi-criminals themselves, not that they're criminals, but that they're willing to really, really stretch the moral line or hop over it in order to get something done. In this story, Miss Clydie shows that she's willing to do that, and it causes her a horrible personal tragedy. And again, and in this one we see that she's not infallible, that in fact, sometimes even someone as gifted as her can screw things up horribly, all because she was willing to cross a moral line because she thought it was the only way to end this bloodshed. But the question is, how far can you, the theme of that book number three is, how far can you go to use evil to combat evil? Sometimes it seems you have to, but you can only go so very far before you become the person you're fighting against. You know what I mean?
Right.
Sort of like Nietzsche's saying about he who studies monsters should see to it that in the case of doing so, he does not himself become a monster, and when you look into the abyss looks back into you. That wasn't an exact quote, but you know the saying, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Can I ask, who are your biggest influences in writing?
My two favorite novelists, my several favorite novelists are the books that have made the really biggest impact on me, are what I call the behemoths, the ones that seem to cover so much that they may deal with a story that covers a long span of time and many events, or it may just cover a single day. But I think of Moby Dick especially, because Moby Dick is so mystical and so, it seems to deal with everything, you know, with faith, with doubt, with revenge, with forgiveness, with mysticism, and to some extent it's simply a very circumstantially accurate account of life on a whale ship. You see what I mean? It seems to be so many things at once. And James Joyce's Ulysses, which covers just parts of 2 days, is the same way. Granted, it's not the kind of book, I've read it more than once, but it's not the kind of book you can just pull up off the shelf and just say, I think I'll read a little bit of Ulysses. No, you definitely have to lock your brain into a Ulysses receptive frame of mind to reread it, and you don't always feel like that. But still, it deals with the very trivial events, hundreds of trivial events in the lives of ordinary people in the course of 2 days, but it seems to deal with the whole world and all of human experience and all different fields of human knowledge. and or like or Crime and Punishment and The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. Again, those books, on the one level, you could say they're just cheap crime thrillers, but they're really about the most important things in the world. You know, what is the human soul? Can faith be stronger than doubt? What is redemption? And why do some people not want to be redeemed? My favorite novels are, like I said, I call them the behemoths because they just seem to incorporate all of human existence and just about everything you could think of in them.
I was just going to say, so if people want to get a hold of you and they want to talk to you about ideas or maybe give you some information, how's the best way they can do that?
They can contact me via James Jeffrey Paul Author, my author page on Facebook, or they can contact me on Twitter, which is at James Jeff, J-E-F-F, Paul, or they can just write me at J-F-P-L, J as in James, F as in Frank, P as in Peter, L as in Larry, at AOL.com. But I really do hope many people will start reading this first book and spread the word, because as I said, there are some very interesting books coming up. May interest you to know that in book 4, Buffet Flat Blues, which is set in the gay lesbian night world of Jazz Age Harlem, Albert Fish and another serial killer, Peter Kudzianowski, are supporting characters. And in book number 5, The World's Children, which is set in north central Texas in the mid-30s, Miss Clyde encounters and works with, hold your chest so you won't have to grasp it when you finish hearing what I'm about to say. H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, and the gospel singer and preacher Blind Willie Johnson are all important supporting characters in that book.
Wow. How are these being released? And like the first one's out now. What's the cycle of how they're going to be put out?
Well, Lee and I have finished pretty much editing books 2, 3, and 4 already. So Lee seems to think it won't take too long. We'd like to bring them out maybe once a month or maybe a little more than a month. But 2, 3, and 4 are practically done, and I'm going to try to finish editing numbers 5, 6, and 7 and get them to Lee as soon as possible so we can get to work with them all. It amuses me that you live in Seattle. I was in Tacoma early last October to do some research on, have you ever heard of Jake Bird, the Tacoma Axe Killer?
You know, I don't think I do. I do.
He claimed to have committed at least a dozen or more murders across the nation. He was in his mid-40s over a period of a couple of decades from the late 20s to the late 40s. And he usually killed his victims with an axe. But since he killed his last two victims, a mother, Bertha Klute, and her daughter in Tacoma in 1947. He was called the Tacoma Axe Killer, and he was hanged in Washington in 49. And it was so incredible. I believe it was the Tacoma Historical Society, where they had this beautiful, beautiful room with a really tall ceiling, and they have a huge collection of clips on Jake Bird and lots of documents about him. And they even had showed me a book I had no idea existed about called Prison Doctor, by a prison doctor in Washington at the time. And more than half the book deals with Jake Bird. That really flummoxed me. And the house where the Klutes were murdered was less than a mile from there, so they just gave me driving directions, and after I'd done all my research, I drove right to the murder house, which was now boarded up. I don't know what they were going to do with it, maybe tear it down, but that was quite a thrill, you know, just an unexpected thrill in just a short period of time, finding so much information. And Jake Bird is in book number 7. He's the principal character.
Well, there we go. Now we know.
I'm afraid, though, that I didn't toss Seattle a bone. I'm sorry, Miss Clydie doesn't meet Ted Bundy or the Green River Killer or anybody else. So, sorry, Seattle strikes out.
That's all right. Yeah, it's the way it goes sometimes. Well, we'll have your book posted on our website as well, and information. So if anybody's looking for it, they can go right to the website. One click, purchase. Definitely recommend it. Very interesting story. Great writer. Our guest has been James Jeffrey Paul, and the book is called The Mulatto Ripper, and this is edition.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
One that's out right now. Yeah, so thank you for being on the show.
And don't forget, if you would mention, it is in both, Grinning Man has brought it out in both paperback and Kindle, but for some reason, the two editions are in separate entries. They're not linked together, and so you have to, and so someone just visiting it, looking it up, might click on Kindle and think, oh, it's just on Kindle, or might go on the paperback and think, oh, it's just on paperback, but I was hoping it was on Kindle. So if you could put both those links up so that people know it's available in both formats.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.